This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, it's hard to believe we're coming up on a year since the Obama Health Reform Initiative began. It's been a rocky road over the past few weeks with healthcare reform efforts, and it doesn't seem to be getting any smoother.
It certainly doesn't, Mark. And the president has now set a meeting with congressional opponents for February 25th for a televised healthcare summit. But leading House Republicans say they might refuse the offer if the White House doesn't choose to start over again with a fresh healthcare bill. Republicans also seem hesitant to participate for fear of winding up looking like props in a White House show of bipartisanship. Although this effort is part of President Obama's plan to live up to that campaign promise of making the negotiations more public.
The Republicans don't want a rerun of the last encounter with the president at their retreat in Baltimore, as they know the president will be speaking past his immediate guest and directly to the American people. And polls show they are opposed to health care reform as it's currently framed in large numbers. The results are a stark reversal from early summer when Americans were supportive of the effort. The Democrats have never recovered from those town hall meetings, and the president knows he needs to turn public sentiment around.
Those poll figures were startling, and a real contrast to Massachusetts, where the polls show the overwhelming majority of people are very satisfied with their own health care reformed system. I heard several congressional staff speak at a meeting this week in Washington, and I'll tell you, Mark, there is a sense of rawness and bitterness there. But the president is vowing to stick by his promise of passing comprehensive reform, and there is a strategy in place for how it could happen using the reconciliation process, though even the experts agree that is really tricky from a parliamentarian point of view.
But there is some good news coming out of Washington in terms of health initiatives. The First Lady, Michelle Obama, unveiled a campaign to fight childhood obesity by improving childhood nutrition and physical activity. According to the National Center for Health Statistics, about two-thirds of all Americans are counted as either overweight or obese, and the government still lacks an effective strategy to tackle the issue.
I was very happy to hear about the obesity campaign. I think it's been about 10 years now, hasn't it?
I think it has.
Since we started our first obesity initiatives here at our community health center. And at the time, it seemed we were the only people in healthcare talking about this. Now it's a major national issue, as it should be. And I'm very glad to see some of our initiatives are being recommended.
The issue of healthcare spending continues to dominate the news. Last week, actuaries at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services reported that U.S. health spending reached $2.5 trillion in 2009, and that healthcare share of the economy continues to grow. Next year, government programs will account for more than half of all U.S. healthcare spending as the weak economy sends more people into the Medicaid program.
Dr. Gail Walensky, who was on our show last week and is a healthcare economist, was quoted the other day in the Wall Street Journal in response to that report. And she said, "It's going to be a desperate issue 5 to 10 years out." The report predicts that by 2020, about $1 in $5 spent in the U.S. will go to healthcare, a proportion that is way beyond any other industrialized nation. Dr. Walensky went on to say that the U.S. will have to decide soon between raising revenue to pay for Medicare or reducing benefits.
Our guest this week, Dr. Robert Berenson, a fellow at the Urban Institute, is here to give us some more perspective on healthcare. Dr. Berenson is a health policy expert as well as a physician and advocates a national solution for healthcare reform versus a state-by-state solution. Dr. Berenson says it would be too much of a financial burden for states to take on enacting their own solutions.
And no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows at our website, chcradio.com. You can subscribe now to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded, or if you want to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com.
And speaking at every word, as always, if you have feedback, send us an email right online at chcradio.com. We would love to hear from you. Before we speak with Dr. Berenson, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, for headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. Healthcare legislation is still stalled in Congress, but President Obama is making every effort to save it from dying. This week, he's engaging his critics through a bipartisan approach to healthcare reform. In an interview with CBS Evening News, he told Katie Couric that he's inviting Republicans to give him their suggestions on health reform.
How do you guys want to lower costs? How do you guys intend to reform the insurance market so people with pre-existing conditions, for example, can get health care? How do you want to make sure that the 30 million people who don't have health insurance can get it?
The half-day bipartisan health care session at the White House, which will be televised live later this month, is also an effort by the president to live up to his campaign pledge that negotiations would be more out in the open. The White House hopes that the public process will boost support and help congressional Democrats pass the bill through a budget reconciliation procedure, requiring just 51 Senate votes instead of 60. Republicans have expressed reservations with the bipartisan summit, going as far as saying they may refuse to participate if the White House doesn't start from scratch with a reform bill. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius responded that President Obama is willing to add various elements suggested by Republicans, but will definitely not draft a new bill. Meanwhile, First Lady Michelle Obama is building her own campaign around health. She's unveiled a comprehensive approach to fighting childhood obesity called the Let's Move campaign. On Tuesday morning, President Obama signed the memorandum that is certain to be the First Lady's legacy.
I am so proud of the work that the First Lady, along with the cabinet secretaries behind me, have done in trying to tackle one of the most urgent health issues that we face in this country.
The First Lady plans to tackle the problem through improved nutrition and physical education in schools, promoting physical activity and community planning, making healthier foods more available, and introducing front-of-the-package labeling. Today, we're happy to have Dr. Robert Berenson as a guest on our show. Dr. Berenson is a fellow at the Urban Institute and an expert in healthcare policy, particularly Medicare. He was in charge of Medicare payment policy and managed care contracting in the Healthcare Financing Administration, now the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, from 1998 to 2000. Before that, in 1993, he co-chaired two working groups as part of the Clinton White House Task Force on Healthcare Reform. Dr. Berenson also spent 3 years on the Carter White House domestic policy staff working on national health policy issues. Dr. Berenson's current research with the Urban Institute has informed the healthcare reform debate in Congress. A recent policy paper he co-authored with the Urban Institute helped Democrats find a compromise on the public option debate. The paper argued for a much stronger public option that would kick in automatically if the healthcare industry didn't meet its promise to slow medical spending. Dr. Berenson is also a board-certified internist who practiced for 12 years in a Washington, D.C. group practice.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. We're speaking today with Dr. Robert Berenson, a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. Thank you for joining us today. Dr. Berenson, last week the Center for Medicare and Medicaid reported the healthcare expenditures consumed 17.3% of the GDP, but it was also accompanied by an equally startling figure that for the first time ever, government programs next year will account for more than half of all U.S. health spending. This is even before the cost of baby boomer generation kicks in 2011. Do you think this figure will motivate the American public and politicians alike that we need to take action now?
Well, I'd say 2 points about that. One is that it's a good thing we have some government programs because a lot of that increase in federal spending was from people who became unemployed and could fall back onto Medicaid. Even though the states are pretty hard-pressed, those public programs serve a major function. And on your major point, is this going to produce the will to do something? I'm skeptical. Everybody's second choice is to do nothing. If somebody's first choice results in cuts in payments to somebody, then there's concerted opposition to change. You know, I've been doing this about 30 years, and every time I think there's going to be a breakthrough, it doesn't happen.
Well, I think we have a lot in common there. And Dr. Berenson, maybe it's the recent blizzard or the loss of the Massachusetts Senate seat, but we just aren't hearing a lot out of Washington on health reform now. We have gotten further down the road this time than at any time in recent history, but it is possible we'll again fail to enact health reform. The Urban Institute is very aware of the consequences of the do-nothing option, and you've modeled that up, and you've had some pretty striking results. Can you share with conversations the cost to the U.S. of doing nothing about health reform at this point?
The basic point is that every year there are increasing numbers of uninsured. That will increase in the future if we don't do health reform, as more employers give up providing insurance to their workers under financial pressures from an ongoing poor economy. We have no control over health care costs, so people with insurance will see their premiums rising far more than the cost of living. And that report from CMS projects that we're going to be close to 20% of the gross domestic product in 10 years left to the normal course of events.
Dr. Berenson, you're quoted as saying we only need to reduce healthcare spending by 1.5% per year to bend the cost curve. That number sounds reasonable, but every dollar is one taken away from someone's income or revenue somewhere. What's the best strategy to achieve that 1.5% reduction?
Well, that's exactly right. So we have an example right now where Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services put out a new regulation, or every year they actually have to put out a new fee schedule for physicians in Medicare. And using new data, they decided that cardiologists, one specialty, could absorb a 13% reduction over 4 years in their net revenues from Medicare by reducing the reimbursement for some overpriced nuclear imaging studies and related services. And what has that produced? The cardiologists are going around trying to kill that regulation going to the courts, going to Congress, going to public opinion, claiming that cardiologists won't be able to survive that cut. Well, cardiologists are earning about $450,000. And the sad part is that they might be successful. So that does raise the issue of the governance. Can Congress actually make these decisions, or are they too responsive to sort of special interest pleading? And should we set up a new governance structure in Medicare? That's one of the issues that has been part of the health reform debate. One other related issue that gets no attention and yet has to be addressed if we're serious about health care costs is the fact that providers generally, and I'm speaking now in particular about hospitals, have figured out how to get extraordinary leverage in their negotiations with health insurers. I'm no big lover of health insurance companies, but when hospitals are able to get 200 or 225% of Medicare as their basic reimbursement, and are able to put aside, these are not, in many cases, not-for-profit hospitals, $100 or $150 million a year in excess revenues that they can just put aside in their bank accounts. We've got a problem that needs to be addressed, and yet you didn't hear anybody talking about that in health reform. So our prices are all screwed up, and we also have, over the longer term, need to move away from the current fee-for-service payment system that rewards, imprudent decision-making, to try to get some control over the volume of services. But in the short term, we need to deal with the prices that are excessive.
Dr. Berenson, a fair criticism, I think, about the health reform bills as they work their way through the Senate in particular is that they became much more about health insurance reform than health care reform. You're an expert on Medicare, and Medicare has certainly tried to improve health care through some of the elements of the Medicare Modernization Act. We haven't seen any slowing of costs, but do you think the emphasis on prevention and chronic disease management that's now embedded in Medicare has a chance of helping to bend the cost curve through healthier enrollees?
Well, paradoxically, the debate became about health insurance reform, and that's what probably will not survive this year unless the president's able to do some political magic over the next few months. What can survive, and is, I think has a good chance, would be an extension of some of the innovation in Medicare, which not only affects Medicare, but in fact, a lot of what Medicare does is emulated by private insurers. So the Medicare Modernization Act, one of which you referred to, one of the major negatives in that legislation was the overpayments to Medicare Advantage private health insurance companies, which are paid about 10% more than Medicare. And so that has led to an increase in health care costs. But some of the other provisions, which could be extended, new payment models, new organization models related to chronic care management, disease management, I think do offer some hope.
We've been speaking with Dr. Robert Berenson, senior fellow at the Urban Institute. Dr. Berenson, we may not see the public option survive, but tell us your thoughts on it. Would the public option spell the end of the private insurance industry, as some people have suggested, or would it simply provide a necessary element of competition for people buying their own health insurance coverage?
I think there's been some misunderstanding about the public option. The way the compromise was working out in the House and the Senate for a public option would have produced a public option that wasn't going to be able to do anything. The value of what Medicare does and what a public option needs to be able to do is essentially not have to negotiate payment rates with providers who develop local monopolies where the purchaser really doesn't have any leverage, but in fact is to set reasonable rates related to the provider's underlying costs of producing the services. That's what the public option needs to be constructed as. It wasn't in the debate. It was going to be a Pyrrhic victory for those who were supporting the public option because it wasn't going to have that ability. If we're serious about cost containment, we should have a public option.
Dr. Berenson, we mentioned the need for payment methodology reform. That seems to have two purposes. One, to focus more on outcomes than just on the volume of fee-for-service procedures. But the other is to try and really pay more to primary care. And you've recommended, I think, to geriatricians. Is there any hard evidence to suggest that this will improve things?
Many of the systems in Europe already are much cheaper, lower, less expensive than the U.S. and produce the same level of quality, are also trying to promote more primary care, especially as patients develop multiple chronic conditions. Some of the data that I've been using, for example, show that 20% of Medicare beneficiaries with five or more chronic conditions see 14 different physicians a year and get over 50 prescriptions a year. Somebody needs to be sorting out all of the contradictory prescriptions that may have drug interactions, all of the different diagnoses that are in many cases incompatible with each other. That is really what some of us envision as the role of primary care, is to really take a much larger role in coordinating across the whole health system on behalf of the patient and with the patient. And I would point out that we don't even have to adopt new payment models to make primary care more desirable. We could simply do what I was suggesting earlier, address overpriced procedures and tests, which Medicare and other payers too generously reward, and reimburse all physicians, but in particular primary care physicians, for spending more time with patients.
Dr. Berenson, you were also the national program director of a program funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation called Improving Malpractice Prevention and Compensation Systems. Tort reform was kept to something of a footnote in the health reform bills, with calls for pilot projects to study alternatives to the current system. More recently, President Obama has indicated a willingness to engage in discussions of tort reform. What are your thoughts on the degree to which tort reform has the potential to have a significant impact on cost?
There's a need to do tort reform, but I don't think it'll have a major impact on cost. That doesn't sound contradictory. There's no question there's a lot of defensive medicine going on. That doesn't mean that there's a lot of costs associated with defensive medicine, because some of the practices that physicians do to avoid suits may actually save money. There's been a fair amount of research in recent years, and there's increasingly a convergence in thinking that defensive medicine does exist, but it may reflect about 1 or 2% of total healthcare spending. We should do malpractice reform, but some of the Republicans who say that that defensive medicine is responsible for 25% of healthcare costs, I've heard figures like that, are just making it up. There's no basis for that. So we should do tort reform. It certainly would provide a basis for bipartisan moving forward, but I don't think people should see tort reform as some kind of magic bullet around reducing costs.
Dr. Berenson, the Urban Institute helped contribute some intellectual firepower to the development of our neighboring state of Massachusetts' near universal health insurance plan. And in retrospect, it really seems even more remarkable they got that passed and implemented. But with the chance for meaningful national health reform somewhat up for debate, the states might be back in the driver's seat of innovation and change. We read in New York Times that states are pushing back already against the possibility of being told they'll have to put an individual mandate in place. How might states approach health reform this time in the context of falling tax revenues? Are there any other models out there for them to embrace?
Very few other states have the commitment, the financial well-being, wherewithal, to be able to do what Massachusetts did. You have states like Texas that have over 20% uninsurance. They're not going to do that. And as it is, even though the federal government would have picked up by far the large share of any expansion in Medicaid in the health reform, the states are still saying that the hit that they were going to take would make their finances that much more fragile. So my own view is we need a national solution, not a state-by-state solution.
Dr. Berenson, you're an internal medicine physician as well as a health policy expert. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see that excites you in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
The New York Times had a profile of Brent James, who was head of Intermountain Healthcare. This was a profile about 3 months ago where they make in Utah. It's an organization that makes a serious investment in trying to figure out how to improve quality at a reasonable cost. And they do a great job, but have basically pointed out that the reimbursement system penalizes them for doing the right thing. So if we could change the reimbursement system, we might get more progress. I think in the area of end-of-life care, this became obviously a hot political item with Republicans, in particular certain prominent Republicans and talk show hosts accusing the Democrats of death panels and things like that for simply promoting an opportunity for patients and their professional caregivers to discuss their options at the end of life. 27% of spending in Medicare occurs in the last year of life, and half of that in the last month. And there's a lot of data demonstrating that patients' own wishes are not honored in the last at the end of life. They're getting more care than they would choose if their wishes were honored. So there's an area where we could actually improve patient well-being, honor their wishes, and save money.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Robert Berenson, a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Berenson.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. On past shows, we've brought you stories about school gardens and urban farming. This week's bright idea focuses on another aspect of this local foods crusade, the backyard chicken movement. The idea of raising poultry right at home is now catching on. The magazine Backyard Poultry now has over 100,000 subscribers. The progression from garden to chicken pen makes sense because the system is nearly self-sustainable. Raising chickens in your backyard is a healthy choice, not simply because it aids garden cultivation. According to Elizabeth Colbert's recent New Yorker article, chickens industrially raised for the eggs they lay live in cages so small they cannot spread their wings, let alone walk around. And when their laying rates decrease, they are often starved up to 2 weeks to reset their biological clocks. Backyard chicken owners are trying to increase public consciousness about the dangers of this system and the benefits of eating more locally. As the Washington Post reported last year, raising backyard poultry has suddenly become as chic as growing your own vegetables. It's all part of the Back to the Land movement, whose proponents want to save on grocery bills, take control of their food supply, and reduce the carbon footprint of industrial agriculture. Owning chickens is relatively easy, because they can live year-round in outdoor coops. Listeners who are interested in learning more about backyard chicken movement and how to raise their own chickens can visit poultryone.com or backyardchickens.com for more information. Raising fresh, healthy food right in your own backyard, now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health